This is the Dairy Download, brought to you by EverAg Insights and the International Dairy Foods Association, where we offer extra sharp market and policy insights on dairy. I'm your host, Phil Plord.
And I'm your co-host, Kathleen Wolfley.
Today's episode is about recession signals. First, we'll speak with an economist from a major bank. Then we chat with an analyst who keeps an eye on traffic trends into restaurants, grocery stores, and other retailers. We'll get to that in a bit. As always, thanks to our listeners. If you enjoy this free podcast being delivered to your inboxes and favorite podcast apps every other week, please, please, please thank our episode sponsor, tell a friend about the show, and leave a review on your favorite podcast app.
Today's sponsor is the Kansas Department of Agriculture. Ready to expand your dairy processing into the premier dairy frontier? There's room to grow in Kansas, the center of it all. Contact dairyinkansas.com.
All right, Kathleen, where are we now?
Phil, how is it December 1st? Hard to believe it. CME spot prices as of Thursday, December 1st. Cheddar blocks closed at $2.10, down a nickel on the week. Barrels closed at $1.90, up 8 cents. Butter fell to $2.88, down 7 cents. And the non-fat dry milk market closed at $1.35, a nickel lower. Phil, I think that the most important thing right now is export competitiveness. We've seen stretches of really competitive U.S. exports as it relates to cheese specifically, but we've seen New Zealand prices coming down a little bit here in the last couple weeks. So I think that the U.S. is starting to face a few more competitiveness headwinds. And I think there are definitely headwinds as it relates to the powder markets and definitely butter as well. So if we keep expanding U.S. milk production into 2023, we're going to need to find some outlets and going to need to see some competitiveness come back into the U.S. market to move that additional product.
Yeah. And along those same lines, I think the most important thing is what happens after, let's say, February 1st or Super Bowl Sunday. You know, right now we're still in the midst of the holiday demand season. There's still stuff moving, you know, the last couple of weeks into the final push into retail channels. But then we're going to hit the dead season right around Super Bowl Sunday. And then it's going to be like, okay, what's going to happen? Is domestic demand going to hold up? To your point, are we going to be able to be competitive in the export arena? And so I think there's a lot of noise at this time of the year. And, you know, it's not surprising to see markets somewhat buoyant. But I think that, you know, the big shift in seasonal environment is not too far away. And I'm starting to really think about what happens there. What's your stat of the week?
Well, I was going to say, it's kind of like that Taylor Swift song, New Year's Day. What happens once all the confetti needs to be cleaned up after New Year's Day, right?
T-swizzle. Words of wisdom. Stat of the week.
My stat of the week is 12,886. That is the number of grocery stores that featured butter Thanksgiving week. That was up 19% from year-ago levels. How about yours, Phil?
You know, there was a great story in the Wall Street Journal a couple of weeks ago about the butter bargain hunters. I'm surprised that we're not part of the club. I mean, these are people that go out and seek the butter bargains and share the information with each other. I mean, who, if we're not there, who is?
I mean, we kind of do that over Slack sometimes, but I mean, it's not being featured in the Wall Street Journal.
Well, yeah, we could go public. My stat of the week is 10.3 million. And that was the number of job openings in the U.S. in October. That was down from 10.7 million in September, but still 4.9 million ahead of the number of unemployed persons. And, you know, today we're going to talk about recession risks. And one of the big factors in all that is employment. And so far, employment numbers look really strong. And this report sort of affirmed that. I mean, if you have 5.5 million or so more jobs than people, that bodes well for at least the near term. Yourself? Fearless prediction time.
Fearless prediction. Okay. I think that we are going to see sub $18 class 3 milk in at least 1 month during the first half of 2023. What's your fearless prediction?
You know, I'm going to throw my lot in with one of our guests and tell you that I believe that crude oil will touch $75 per barrel before it hits $90 per barrel. So that's WTI crude oil futures. That's what I'm thinking over the near term.
Okay. Mark them down, everybody. All right, Phil, let's get to our first guest.
Today, we're excited to speak with Michael Swanson. Michael is Chief Ag Economist with Wells Fargo, where he analyzes the impact of energy on agriculture and forecasts for key agricultural commodities. Prior to joining Wells Fargo, Michael worked with Land O'Lakes, Cargill, and Burlington Northern Railway. Michael, welcome to the show.
Well, it's a pleasure to be talking to you today.
So let's just start high level, big picture. In your opinion, are we in, near, or turning away from a recession?
Well, you know, how we look at recessions, we have two things people hear a lot about. One is two back-to-back quarters of contraction. And that kind of kicked off this year as kind of contentious because on the adjusted inflation-adjusted GDP, we did have two very minor back-to-back quarters of contraction. But the National Bureau of Economic Research, which does most of this recession analysis, also looked at things like real income, real spending, payroll, household employment, and industrial production. None of those have been in a contraction mode. A couple have been sideways, but of those five major things, there's been slight growth in three and sideways movement in two. So no, we have not been in recession. We're not in a recession. Are we going to go into recession? Well, economists love predicting recessions, but I don't know. I mean, it depends on what the Fed does. It depends on what, you know, that happens in the war in Ukraine. There's a lot of things. Is it a given that we're going to be in a recession in 2023? Absolutely not. And if it is, what type of recession? Shallow, deep? Those are just unanswerable questions. So they're not worth worrying about. It's better to spend your time adjusting rather than worrying about that forecast.
So I guess thinking about if we do see a recession into 2023, what do you think that could mean for dairy demand?
It won't mean much at all in the sense that it's going to change how much people want to eat dairy product. You know, you look at the last two large recessions, 2009 and 2020. In 2009, even with that, with very little food inflation, we still saw an increase in consumer expenditures on food. In 2020, which was a very unique animal of a recession, we saw major expansions of food spending during recession. So we don't see people contract the amount that they spend on food, but they do get a little bit more picky about where they spend it. At home more, less in the restaurants, maybe a few more private label options, less brand. So food spending for dairy will not go down because of recession, but you better be careful what kind of battle you want to pick in terms of brand versus private label during that environment.
In a recent blog post of yours, you wrote that the competition between different crops and foods can be intense during a recession as consumers look for better values. I think you were getting at there just now. Can you give us an example of how that competition plays out, say at retail?
Sure. You know, let's take organic, which is kind of an interesting market element. You know, organic is a story as well as the food, and you can choose to eat that story or not. So say we have a recession. One thing to remember, say we have a very mild recession, we might see only one person out of 100 lose their jobs, but the other 99 are nervous. And so they're saying, okay, how do I get more bang for my buck? So then organic very well might find a trade factor where people say, well, I'm going to eat conventional because I get a much better value for that. So even within a category, whether it's dairy or fruits, you know, you can see a trade between organic and conventional, not because they have to, but because they want to, you know, build their cash reserves until they feel more confident about themselves. And I alluded to just a little while ago, brand versus private label. We see those type of adjustments being made. Spending doesn't go down, but it goes into different channels during that process.
How did the 2009 recession impact food manufacturing and marketing? Do you think that there are any similar impacts that we might see into 2023?
You know, it'd be very different. 2009, we were in a very low food inflation environment, if you go back and look at it. So to have growth in food spending during a recession, it was very modest. We've had a lot of food inflation in the past year, and we're going to still have more food inflation going forward. There's still more packaging, raw material costs, freight and labor that's moving through the system. So even in a recession, I would expect to see food spending come up more than you might expect. Where will people get that money? Well, they'll put off a big screen TV purchase. They won't go to Disney World that year. There's a lot of other levers to pull that free up a couple $1,000s rather than food spending.
One of the things as we analyze a lot of the data that you're looking at, you know, day to day, week to week, you know, that strikes me personally is that I think the consumer tends to be more resilient than we give he or she credit for. And I understand the big screen TV versus, you know, lunch out versus cooking at home. I understand those trade-offs. But by and large, do you think that we underestimate the consumer's resilience?
Yes, a couple of things that we have to take into consideration. One is government transfer payments. You know, we've seen what was very different about 2020 in food spending was we saw incredible and just incredible transfer payments from the government. A lot of those went to my children who were either graduate students or unemployed because they were just getting out of school. And a lot of Uber Eats was paid for by that. So yes, so transfer payments are a built-in mechanism for resiliency. And secondly, people do take on debt during a recession because they know it won't be forever and they're not going to stop their lives. So between transfer payments and debt growth, you do see a very robust spending, which is why we come out of recessions and don't just spiral down to nothing.
Yeah, I've seen some alarms being raised over the credit expansion, and those numbers have been, you know, sizable. In my amateur opinion, there's still some runway there, right? I mean, against historical levels of credit, you know, it doesn't feel like we're overextended yet, right?
Well, you know, you can always find an example of anything you want, but as a metric, you want to look at debt to income and wealth. Those are two very important things because you can always say, hey, we have the greatest level of debt ever. Well, of course we do. We have inflation. We have a growing economy, more people. The question is, do we have more debt relative to current income levels and assets? So when you look at that proportionality, it doesn't look that different. And so, yeah, there's plenty of runway around that debt. Now, individually, some people won't be maxed out, but there are plenty of people who are nowhere near that.
Can you talk a little bit about anticipated changes to the labor market and labor availability?
That's a great question. You know, we still have almost all of the people we finance in the food manufacturing and food retail side. They're all looking for employees still. We just got out the JOLTS report this morning, which is job openings, layoffs, you know, turnover. And we still have 1.7 jobs for every one person that's unemployed. Part of that problem is we're down about 1% plus on the labor force participation number. That's how many people between the ages of 16 and 65 are either working or looking for work. Well, what's 1%? Well, given the size of the U.S. economy and our labor force, that's about 3.5 million people. And we're asking ourselves, well, where are these 3.5 million people that don't feel the need to work or even look for work? You know, and that's really one of the questions. So labor force participation and how many people could work if they needed to work, it's a big issue. I'm going to circle back to something I just talked about. The biggest competitor for employees in this market is the government. I mean, it's a pretty sweet gig. You get money for nothing. And it's really hard for any employer to compete against that. The question is, why are we competing against the government? You know, so that's a tough one. So the labor market's still very, very tight. Everybody's still dealing with accelerated turnover, especially in some of those drudgery jobs that nobody really wants to have. And so it's a tough labor market right now. And what would happen in a recession? One follow-on. If there's a recession, then that willingness to quit goes away. The number of jobs open decline. And we start to see people kind of change how they expect their labor to look. I mean, their opportunities. So there's a lot going on. A lot of variables, not many constants.
What forces do you think will be shaping the grain markets over the course of winter and into spring?
You know, the obvious ones are right up there. You know, it's the Russian-Ukraine conflict, you know, will it get resolved soon enough in 2023 to anticipate that they'll get back to producing grain like they did in 2020? You know, that's the question. So that's a big one. Then global GDP growth, you know, what kind of growth are we seeing in those major grain importing countries? You know, are they doing well economically? You know, is the currency strong enough to make the U.S. an attractive source on that? Right now we have the crop in the bins, you know, and we can talk weather and we will talk weather. But it's going to be demand between now and the next planting season that people are going to be focusing on.
And do you see anything particular moving the needle on that demand? I mean, what, you know, is it just China, China, China? Are there other things in play?
Well, you know, what's interesting is typically grain demand and commodity demand in general around food is very slow to change. You know, population and dietary change are not things that happen rapidly. What changes a lot is the stocks, where they are, who holds them, and what kind of concern do you have about replenishing that? So China, you know, always a big factor in the market, but we see good growth. You know, whether it is Indonesia, the Philippines, or African markets, those are big drivers of the demand delta. At the same time, when grain prices are high in the markets, those have organic sources of growth that they can look to as well. I mean, if you offer a farmer better prices in Africa, they'll grow more grain. It's just like everybody else.
Do you think that the renewal of the Russia-Ukraine trade agreement has provided any relief in recent months? And do you think that we can expect that situation to improve in the coming months?
You know, there's two parts to that. One is, you know, it did help get existing stocks back into the market, which has been good. But the question is, how much of those existing stocks are still there and need to be moved under that agreement? I have no idea. We know it's a number and plenty of wide estimates around there. But I'll go back to something I said earlier, is the question is, can Ukraine get back to a more normal growth pattern on it? Can it plant those acres? Can it get the inputs? You know, that's really the question. So the trade agreement to allow it to move out products is great. But when we're looking at 2023 and 2024 beyond, the question is, what are they going to bring to the market in new supply? And that's a much more difficult thing.
Speaking of the difficult things to pinpoint, you mentioned China earlier. Can you talk a little bit about your thoughts on where is China heading in the next, I guess, in 2023?
You know, I don't think we're going to see a big change out of China. You know, the zero COVID policy has been a major issue, you know, a lot of speculation around that. But China's been pretty robust around its importation of U.S. products and global products. It has to. But the one thing China will not allow to happen is have a food revolution in China. That's the type of thing that really does cause the whole thing to go to pieces on them. So I don't expect a large change in the Chinese dynamic in 2023 versus where it was 2022. We're still working through some of those trade agreements that Trump worked with the Chinese. They seem to be performing against those relatively well. You know, they can choose commodities where they see, you know, advantage or disadvantage for that purpose. But, you know, they're always a big part of the market moves. But do they really change a lot? No, it's just that any small change in a market that big makes a big impact.
So shifting back to, I guess, more U.S. focus, where do you think the weather is going to play a sizable role in the dairy markets, I guess, both in the U.S. and globally heading into 2023?
Well, you know, it's the cost of feed. And so we really didn't have that bad of a year. If you look at the combined yield of corn and soybeans, take all the acreage into consideration, let's say we're down 1.5%. 1.5% is not a huge number, but in a very inelastic market, it makes a big difference. So if we have more normal weather, we'll start to see grain prices, you know, $6 corn become, let's say $6.60 corn becomes $6 corn or $5.80 corn. We'll see $400 per ton alfalfa become $325 or $315. Obviously, that's going to help the milk feed ratio, and that becomes more positive on expansion. Right now, those are very high hurdles to get over to want to say you're going to get $20 and $21 class three milk to get expansion. But the other thing I'd caution you is that it's all about cash flow. And a lot of the dairy operators have had very good cash flow over the last couple of years, especially the stronger operators. So they're not operating on today's ratios. They're operating on today's ratios plus their cash that they have in their checking account.
All right, Michael. So the old joke goes that economists have predicted 9 out of the past 5 recessions. As we have 2023 in our sights, are there any predictions you'd like to make about next year that are a little off the radar or not something we've talked about yet today?
You know, I a couple of things. One is the energy market will probably soften. You know, I'm more of a bear around energy prices. Once again, Russian-Ukraine conflict, if that goes away, probably expect resurgence in Russian supply into the European market, which would take a lot of premium out of the natural gas market, which would help nitrogen costs in a big way. Secondly, you know, when you look at the current U.S. situation, it is actually astonishing. I'll use that word, and I won't use it lightly, astonishing. We have record current exports of petroleum products and crude oil going on in this country. We are a large net exporter. A couple things. One is we've been releasing a lot of strategic petroleum reserve supply. Well, we don't need it, so it's going elsewhere. So that's a big deal. But secondly, we're pretty well balanced right now, even with a modest recovery in crude oil production and a strong recovery, what we've seen in what they call natural gas plant liquids, we still have more supply domestically than we have need, especially at these prices. So I think we'll see crude oil, which is right now, say, you know, in, you know, that $80 plus range, we'll see it roll back into the low 80s, maybe even the upper 70s. Now, that puts me completely at odds with Goldman Sachs, to say something. And everybody has their forecast. But when I look at that market, I say that's good news for a lot of industries, especially for the ag industry. Natural gas getting cheaper, cheaper nitrogen. crude oil getting cheaper, cheaper diesel. So I think there might be some relief. Now, it's not going to be massive. We're not going back to $40 crude oil within 2023. But I think there's more bearish news out there than there is bullish news.
Well, Dr. Swanson, we really appreciate your time today and joining us on the Dairy Download.
It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Now let's get the lowdown on store traffic.
We're excited to have RJ Hottavy with us today. RJ is head of analytical research for Placer AI. His career includes nearly 20 years covering the restaurant, retail, and e-commerce sectors for a variety of companies. We keep an eye on some of his work, and let me tell you, it's very interesting. RJ, welcome to the Dairy Download.
Thanks, Phil.
Can you tell us a bit about Placer.ai's work? What kind of data and analytics does the company track? And who are your primary audiences?
Sure. So Placer AI is a location-based analytics company powered by mobile data. In simpler terms, that means we partner with a number of mobile apps that are pretty common, lifestyle, insurance, finance, shopping. And with that partnership, we are able to track devices on a 24/7 basis. We get no personal information about the user of those devices. There's no way possibly the way it's configured in our platform, which keeps us on the right side of all the security and privacy laws that are out there. But what it allows us to do is come up with foot traffic estimates for any physical property in the United States, whether it's a retail location, a chain of stores, a city, even a plot of land or an intersection. That is what we specialize is in foot traffic estimates, knowing where people come from, how long they stay in a store, and where they go to after. But more recently, we've evolved into much more of a data marketplace where we can partner with data sets like Census, GeoWeb, Spatial AI, different things that we can layer on top of our data to put together a mosaic of that customer coming in, understand that profile, but not, again, use any personal identifiable information with it as well. So again, foot traffic, geolocation, we are the market leader right now, and we've been helping a lot of companies across a number of different categories. Recently we've been expanding to restaurants, cities, financial services companies, mutual funds, hedge funds, really you name it. CPG is starting to be a big category for us. The groups that want to understand the best retailers for go-to-market strategies. So the quick 2.5-minute overview on Placer there.
Yeah, I mean, dairy market analysts are actually interested in it. But I look on the national blog where they show where you show restaurant traffic. That's one of the things we try to follow is, to see basically where are people going and find it very interesting. So the holiday season is hot underway. How do you see things shaping up compared to last year and other years in the food space? And I would say that's for grocery stores and restaurants.
Yeah, it's a good question, a great starting point, because I think this is where we've seen the shift in consumer behavior more pronounced than any other category. If you trace back to really the what we had to start this year, we were still looking at strong year-over-year visitation trends in January and February, even with Omicron and some of the COVID variants that we had. But it was like a light went off in consumers' head that first week in March when we saw that really big spike in gas prices. And I think that's when consumers just realized, wait a minute, all these things are starting to be hit. It's not just gas inflation, but I've been dealing with double-digit food inflation or almost high single-digit, almost double-digit food inflation, both at restaurants and grocery stores. On top of that, rent's not getting any cheaper. And I think that was the moment consumers started shifting more towards value. It was almost instantaneously we started to see this shift towards value-priced grocers like an Aldi and a Lidl. We started to see a shift to quick service restaurants. We started to see dollar stores and even C stores start to gain some share. And what was interesting, though, is as we progressed further on through the year, the price increases that we started to see, again, inflation didn't go away. The price increases that we started to see both at restaurants and grocery stores really started to take its toll. And now we're starting to see year-over-year trends, visitation trends down for most chains, even the value-priced grocers and QSR companies. And so I think that overall, I think that consumer right now is looking for value. And I think that's kind of the mindset is that everyday consumers are looking for value. We've seen this trade down, too. This lower to middle-income consumer that had been shopping Walmart and Target has now shifted down to dollar dollar stores and C-stores in some cases, that middle-income consumer that had been going to Whole Foods and other high-end specialty grocers is now going to, you know, Walmart and Target, that kind of 75K and above in household income. So it's been fascinating to watch in real time, and that's the beauty of our data. It's near real time. We can track things as short as 3 days ago and just to kind of see. So I think, you know, there's certainly a demand for entertaining and people wanting to get together with their friends. I mean, so many people have moved, so many people have new homes, and frankly, a lot of people haven't had a chance to celebrate the holidays in, you know, many years. So I think that there's a huge demand for entertaining, but I think budget's going to be one of the key things that people keep in mind as they, you know, look to celebrate the holidays this year.
And what's interesting from where I sit is that, you know, gasoline prices, as you know, started to go up in March. They actually peaked like the first week of June and then, you know, steadily trended lower since then. So it is kind of interesting to see the consumer behavior. You know, the first shift was understandable, but they haven't really shifted back from what you see?
Not so much. And I think it's just that compounding effect. I mean, it was, you know, to your point, gas prices, you know, have come down. But what we look at is, you know, overall visits to gas stations themselves are down pretty considerably year over year. So I think that just shows that people are, you know, being conscious of their budgets, looking to stretch their household budgets a bit more, and really looking for value and finding creative ways to do it this holiday season.
Do you see anything today or in the near future to suggest current headwinds will weaken or the economy will start to stabilize as we get into 2023?
It's a great question. And really, I think there's kind of two answers to it. I think that we're seeing a pretty big bifurcation. I've spent most of the time talking about that lower middle income consumer, but generally speaking, that high end consumer, we continue to see strength out of that. You know, the retailers that, you know, the high end retailers, you know, are seeing visitation trends stabilize. I think that high end consumer is shaking off a lot of the noise we saw with the stock market earlier this year. There's headlines about the housing market, but really in most markets, the home prices are well above where they were. And so those markets, we generally see retail trends for higher end retailers doing pretty well. And I think that continues into next year. I don't see any immediate changes on that. The interesting wrinkle to this is what, you know, rising interest rates might do. Does that impact, is, you know, housing payments go up, you know, car payments go up? Does that start to impact that higher end consumer? We're not seeing a lot of evidence of that yet. That's a potential headwind, but I don't think that's going to be as big. But that lower end consumer, I think, is going to be very much focused on value, particularly through the first half of next year. I don't see any major changes, but midway through next year, I think we might be looking at a situation where, you know, they're in a better position. They've adjusted to the inflation headwinds. Maybe wage growth starts to offset that a bit. You know, but really, I think it's going to be status quo as we look into early 2023. Very much focused on value and budget, being very budget conscious for the low to middle income consumer, and that high end consumer continue to spend, but maybe a little bit more restrained. Maybe not, you know, as much as what we would have had with interest rates rising there.
So if we shift our focus to a little bit more on the food side of things, do you think that there are any key either restaurant categories or grocery retail categories that are really going to benefit from the current situation into 2023?
Yeah, I think value grocery is a very interesting situation. Those places where you do perceive yourself getting a good value. So in Aldi, a grocery outlet, they're doing, you know, exceptionally well compared to the rest of the group right now. And I think that's going to continue. I think if you look at kind of those groups, at least in the third quarter, that outperformed on a visitation standpoint, those did very well. But value is not the only thing that's going to really drive it. I think that's kind of the one thing that a lot of retailers have forgotten about, that there is a level of innovation in having the right product in there, and just things that are new and exciting that people maybe you haven't seen before. You know, we went through COVID, and a lot of these companies and these chains really cut back on the number of SKUs and number of items they had on the shelf, just to kind of keep things streamlined and, you know, and operationally kind of straightforward. And, you know, by doing that, you kind of cut out innovation. And, you know, we've seen cases where if you add a new product or a new vertical or something that gets people talking, it can have a pretty meaningful impact on visitation trends. So, you know, we've seen Trader Joe's. That's been a group that caught our eye a couple of times. Obviously, there is a value focus there too, but I think it's much more, it's innovation. And if you look at kind of the demographics for the trade area that they operate in, the people coming to the stores, it's a lot higher than, you know, what you might think. And I think a lot of that has to do with the innovation front. So I think it starts with value, but it's not enough to just be a value conscious one. You also have to add innovation. So, and I think that message permeates through not just the grocery channel, but I think restaurant, that's another thing we've seen. McDonald's has done an exceptional job on the innovation front through some of its celebrity meals. They ran an adult Happy Meal promotion in the month of October with a streetwear company called Cactus Plant Flea Market, which is one of the most exceptional limited time offers that we've ever seen. Drove almost 35% growth in store compared to previous weeks for that week they launched it. In fact, raised the entire category by almost 6 points, the entire quick service restaurant category. So we've actually had to start using a chart with that strip down just to get the examples of apples right now. So, but just kind of shows you, you know, things like Taco Bell's Mexican pizza, things like that. Just a little bit of innovation goes a long way right now. People are, you know, they're excited to get back out to restaurants and grocery stores, but they want something to be able to talk about it when they get back home. And, you know, so innovation is still critical on top of things like value and really focus on operations as well.
I think that it's a true sign that I'm getting old when those McDonald's ads roll out and I have no idea who the celebrity is. No idea.
I've got my 11-year-old by my side for most of those discussions, just so I know who I'm talking about. So I completely agree with you.
Is there anything about geography that's interesting about the current times? I mean, is there anything regionally that you're seeing that's of interest in the food space? I mean, you know, the Southeast versus the rest of the country, East versus West, or is it all pretty homogenous from where you guys sit?
Pretty homogenous. There are some subtle regional differences, and I'd say this is one where we did see a shift to value in the West Coast markets where gas prices were higher, particularly kind of the second quarter of the year through kind of the end of summer. But that's dissipated a bit. But I do think that that's kind of, we do continue to see a shift towards value more pronounced in the California market. However, the Southeast, and I would say that's kind of Texas through Florida, generally speaking, that group has held up better than some of the other categories, some of the other areas of the country. Midwest is kind of a mixed bag, depends on what you're talking about. Kind of depends. Actually, there it's more interesting because we've seen differences between suburban and urban. We've seen this big migration away from urban centers, big markets where we saw a big migration away from San Francisco, but Chicago is another market where we saw a lot of people move away from. And so in those cases, you know, grocery shopping in suburban markets is actually, and even rural is outperforming urban markets. It's a little bit, but it's, you know, that trend has held up pretty much throughout this year. And honestly, it's something that a lot of our grocery store partners are starting to think about. Maybe instead of putting that additional location into an urban market, maybe thinking about suburban and rural markets, because we are seeing a ton of population growth, particularly in the, I'd say the South and then the kind of Midwest mountain range.
So what are some interesting pieces of data in the food space that you're watching as we go into next year?
One of the things that's really caught our eye, and it's something that we think there's multiple reasons behind it, is the actual dwell time at grocery stores. You know, the amount of time that people spend in grocery stores from, you know, the time they come in to the time they come out has actually gone up by about 2 minutes, you know, from the second quarter to the third quarter. This is across the entire category, both value and conventional grocery. And it's got us thinking why that we were actually kind of above where we were in you know, pre-pandemic times in terms of the actual dwell time. And so one of the things that, you know, we've got a number of theories on it, but I think the idea one is that people are spending more time comparing prices in the shelves, looking at where I can get the better deal for. So they're taking their time with that. I think labor is still an issue pretty much across all food retail, whether that's restaurants, whether that's grocery stores. And so that, you know, they may not be completely running at peak efficiency. You know, maybe they're still, we haven't completely ironed out all the supply chain issues that we had about this time last year. So there may be some element of that, but also just, you know, frankly, there's more people in the stores too than, you know, what we were, at least, you know, at the depths of the pandemic. We're down a little bit year over year, but we're certainly above where we were during the pandemic. So it's interesting to us, the dwell time is, you know, something that, you know, people spending more time in the store themselves has been interesting to look at.
Kathleen and I are notorious grocery store dwellers. No one wants to go grocery shopping with us in our families, as a matter of fact, because it's like a little lab experiment every week. RJ, thank you so much for joining us. Love the work at Placer AI and appreciate your insights today. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That's a wrap for today's show. As always, we want to thank our production team, Matt Herrick, Michael Gooden, and Andrew Jerome at IDFA, and Corey Romero over here at EverAg Insights. If you are interested in what Kathleen and I do for our day jobs, check us out at ever.ag. Remember, if you enjoy the show, hit the subscribe button and leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform.
Thanks again to today's sponsor, the Kansas Department of Agriculture. Top-ranked transportation and shipping, along with being one of the fastest-growing milk-producing states, makes Kansas the center of it all. Contact dairyinkansas.com. Thanks for listening to the Dairy Download. Until next time, stay sharp.